Max darted over to Anya just as she hung up with Bart. He'd seen her talking on the phone, but he didn't question her.
I booked passage for us on the Grand Taxi line. It's a 300-mile trip across the desert to Marrakesh. It'll take 7 to 8 hours to get there, at least, but there's no guarantee of safety along the way. Habib will know about the dig team. He'll know about Mustafa.
The police will give him that information?
They won't know it's Habib asking. They'll work through a go-between.
I understand, but what I don't get is why Habib is interested in this.
I don't know. That part of this little tea party is your specialty. I'm just going to work on keeping us alive. We're pulling out in 30 minutes. Is there anything you need?
No, thank you.
Okay, excuse me.
Mac returned to his team, and Anya pulled out the piece of the scroll she'd managed to escape with. She didn't know if the answer to Habib's interest was there, but the scroll was all she had. Habib ibn Thabit stood inside the pilot house of his 210-foot yacht and watched over the Algiers harbor. The number of boats had increased out on the water as shipments had come in, and some of those were doubtlessly manned by CIA agents or their assets. They didn't know about his boat, and the true ownership was hidden beneath a snowstorm of paperwork, so he felt safe enough. The main flurry of searches for the attackers on the warehouse the previous day had died down. Dressed and fresh from the shower, Habib drank sparkling water from a champagne flute. On a low hill overlooking the harbor, the Kasbah looked like something out of a fantasy story. Habib pulled his gaze from the old buildings of the Kasbah and glanced at the satellite-fed television that hung in the corner of the helm. Reporters were still on the scene at the warehouse where the CIA agents had been ambushed. Fire had spread through the building, but it had been quickly brought under control. Still, the warehouse had suffered major damage. According to the reports, several people were dead, including a handful of rescue personnel. Once it had been discovered that many of the dead were suspected of being American intelligence operatives, the Algerian police and military had closed in rapidly. Journalists still got tipped to the story and the probable identity of the dead men, and the story was blazing across the news services. The CIA would have its hands full trying to contain the event, explaining the men there and spinning damage control.
Sir, if I may.
Turning, Habib found Rashid standing behind him. Rashid was one of Habib's chief sources of information. Slim and dapper, with a blue velvet eye patch covering his right eye, Rashid had spent half of his 40 years in the United States, learning technology as well as how the Western minds worked. Not once had he forgotten he was a Muslim living in a land of enemies. During that time, he had gone to college, worked in Washington, D.C. as a political aide to garner the American Muslim votes, and had gotten to know several people within the intelligence communities. A few years ago, his cover had been blown when the CIA had been on a fishing expedition. He'd barely gotten away with his life, and he'd lost his eye. When he was on a mission, he wore a prosthesis instead of the patch. But when he was around Habib, Rashid wore the patch. It was his badge of honor.
Yes?
I have some bad news, sir.
What is it?
Our agents in Erfoud were unable to take Anya Creed into custody.
What happened?
Someone else was there and aided her. If you wish, I can show you.
Habib nodded. He followed the smaller man to the inner offices of the yacht. From the military command-style operations room, everything in the wheelhouse could be operated. Computer hardware covered the walls. Rashid stood in the center of the room and held the small tablet PC that allowed him to control the computers. At his touch, a 60-inch monitor rose out of a recessed area in the floor.
The hotel where Anya Creed was staying had no security cameras, nor did any of the buildings on the other side of the streets that surrounded the building. However, there were a few people who saw what happened and took video on their phones and cameras, which they later uploaded to YouTube, Facebook, and other social networks. My data miners sought them out, and I patched them together.
The resulting video was patchy and jerky, and it jumped from place to place. Habib watched in silence as the interception team strode into the hotel. Within minutes, gunshots broke out.
They escaped through the rear of the building.
Rashid touched the tablet again. This time, the image on the monitor magnified, showing Anya Creed in the alley behind the hotel. She stood near a tall black man.
They escaped?
Yes, Anya Creed and this man.
Rashid stroked the tablet PC again, and the image on the screen magnified, losing some of the sharpness.
After enhancing this image, I have managed to identify him through facial recognition.
A yellow rectangle suddenly framed the man's face and lifted it out of the screen. A window on the other side of the screen opened and began rapidly flicking through images until it froze on the new picture, which showed the man standing in an office building with an assault rifle canted in the crook of his arm. He looked fierce and hard-edged.
His name is Rafe McKenzie. From all accounts, he is a mercenary, but he also moonlights for the CIA. I believe they brought him into this situation.
Then the Americans have not yet given up their hopes of running me to ground. What do we know about McKenzie?
He's worked as an asset for the CIA in years past.
In what capacity?
Anything the agency wanted that requires guts. McKenzie works on the contracted hits and operations.
Why would the CIA involve McKenzie with this woman?
I can only assume the Americans realized you were interested in the discovery Anya Creed has made in Morocco.
How would the CIA have discovered my interest in Creed's find?
I have no immediate answer to that, but I will look into it.
Do so.
At once.
Habib headed for his private rooms on the yacht. He tapped the headset that linked him to the yacht's control center.
Captain Abu.
Yes, sir.
Get us away from here.
Yes, sir. What heading would you like?
Make for Morocco. Put us in international waters.
Yes, sir.
In his suite, Habib poured himself a fresh glass of sparkling water and got out his prayer rug. He took off his shoes and knelt facing east. For a moment, he merely sat there and breathed, while his mind wrestled with everything going through it. He had solved one problem rather easily, but now he had another before him. Habib pushed the incoming call through to his television. The screen shimmered, then revealed Mirza Almodarresi. A few years older than Habib, Mirza was graying at the temples. He was also a little heavier because he no longer took care of himself as he had when he was younger. Like Habib, he preferred Western clothes, but he also wore a keffiyeh headdress. Almodarresi and his ilk depended on the oil industry that fueled the Bahrain economy.
Hello, Habib. I trust you are well.
I am, Mirza. Thank you. I trust you are also well.
Yes. I see that you have been busy. Are you going to tell me that you are not responsible for the deaths of the CIA agents in Algiers?
Have they been confirmed as CIA agents?
We are friends. Please do not insult me.
As you say. In answer to your question as to the deaths of those CIA operatives, yes, I am responsible.
You are valuable to us. We would not see you lost.
I would desire not to be lost even more than you wish it.
Then why do you antagonize the Americans?
They planted a mole within my organization.
You did not know this?
Of course I knew this. The work we have been doing has not been compromised. God looks out for us, as he always has.
Why did you not simply get rid of the mole?
I did. I shot him myself yesterday.
You could have done that quietly.
The CIA has been closing in on some of my operations. I wanted to create some breathing space. It would do you and the others no good if I allowed myself to be hemmed in.
Do you truly think you are becoming hemmed in, my friend?
I do, and I believe I am the authority in this matter. Know that I will never make a habit of checking in with you before I choose to do something, Mirza. Do not do yourself the foolish disservice of ever thinking that I might.
People worry that you are becoming too aggressive, Habib.
And I am convinced we are not being aggressive enough. We need to strike back now, while the West is afraid and fragmented.
To follow that course of action is to further reveal ourselves. This mole you killed is proof that they know who you are. Once the West knew who Osama bin Laden was, his days were numbered.
Are you saying my days are numbered?
All of our days are numbered, my friend. But bold moves will shorten the number of those you have left. Be more patient.
You do not fight a war patiently.
No, but you change the world patiently. We are working God's will. We need to keep that uppermost in our minds.
I am a holy warrior, Mirza. I am Allah's weapon against the unbelievers.
I know this, my friend. We are also worried that you will draw the wrath of the Sunnis upon yourself. Iran and some of the other nations fear Western and Israeli aggression as a result of the attacks.
No, The worst aggression that the West sees is the alliances being made between Muslim warriors and criminal organizations. They have seen through the curtains you and your people have tried to pull over funding. The Western powers are targeting those endeavors more than they are targeting anything I am doing. Greed is bearing the bones of those operations, making them more vulnerable.
There are many who would not like it that you say such things.
Tell me I am wrong.
You are wrong.
The men I lead against the West are true Shiites, Mirza. They are not infatuated with worldly riches. Allah has their fortunes awaiting them in the next world for their sacrifices. I must take my leave, Mirza. There are many things I must attend to.
As you will, Habib. But do take my words into consideration.
Of course. May Allah watch over you.
And you.
Habib ended the call and the connection to the television. He turned his thoughts to Anya Creed and the problem she presented. Even though he did not presently know where she was, there was a way to find her. He punched up Rashid's ops room on his phone.
Yes, sir.
We have lost Anya Creed.
For the moment. I expect to have her whereabouts soon.
She is going to Marrakesh, is she not? You said she was trying to find help for the archaeological crew kidnapped by Bedouin slavers.
Yes.
Put a team in Marrakesh. Let them seek out these Bedouins. Perhaps we can get ahead of this woman, and she will come to us.
Of course.
Habib hung up and walked over to one of the windows. The Algerian harbor receded, and they motored past a sailboat with a full-bellied canvas taking advantage of the wind. The yacht's powerful engines vibrated the floor beneath his feet, and the vessel rose and fell slowly as it pushed out to sea. Cramped and uncomfortable, Anya sat in the Grand Taxi's rear seat, squashed between Mac and two of his men as they rode towards Marrakesh. Outside, darkness crept across the eastern sky and stretched toward the west. They were due to arrive in Marrakesh at midnight. Anya occupied herself on her tablet PC with the information Bart had sent her regarding Habib ibn Thabit. As Bart had said, the man was dangerous and wanted in a dozen countries. Habib had been born and raised in Bahrain. Then, 12 years ago, at the age of 20, he'd disappeared. It hadn't been until Habib's name had started turning up in terrorist-related counter-espionage operations that anyone figured out who he was. Anya had also sent Bart a picture of Mac and discovered that the mercenary's real name was Raphael McKenzie, and he was born in Mobile, Alabama. He'd graduated high school. Then, like Habib, the man's bio grew sketchy, a mix of half-truths, outright lies, and cover stories. His background as a mercenary was solid, but he'd been a lot of other things over the years as well. He hadn't returned to the United States very often.
Where'd you get your information on Habib?
I've got a good friend on the New York police force.
What did your friend tell you?
Habib led a very affluent life in Bahrain for a while.
Anya nodded at the tablet PC. The image there showed a young Habib ibn Thabit.
Then when he was 20, he left college, left Bahrain, and went to Afghanistan.
Joined up with Osama bin Laden?
No, but he did join up with Shiite terrorists training inside Helmand Province. He was identified by U.S. Marines and barely avoided getting killed when the United States attacked the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Those were interesting times. Couldn't go home again.
Habib could and did, but it wasn't to hide out. He started recruiting hardcore Shiite believers to his cause to bring the West to its knees.
It's guys like that who keep me in business. You know all that, but you have no idea why the man would be interested in you or what you found out there in those mountains.
No.
Are your GPS locators still keeping track of Mustafa and his group?
They are.
Maybe when you get to see the rest of that scroll, you'll know more.
Possibly. The main thing is getting those people safe.
When McKenzie didn't answer her, she felt disappointed and slightly irritated. Trying to relax the tension in her neck, she laid her head back and drifted off to sleep. A rough hand shook Anya awake.
Hey, wake up.
She curled her right hand into a fist and almost smashed it into McKenzie's face before she realized what was going on. His eyes widened in surprise, but he'd already caught her fist in his. The car was stopped in darkness out in front of a small building. A few streetlights lined the thoroughfare, but to the north, she got her bearings from the compass app on her phone, she saw a large pool of light It must have come from Jemma el-Fena, one of the main squares in the city of Marrakesh. Around her, the men climbed out of the taxis. Mackenzie paid the drivers, and the vehicles immediately headed in the direction of the square. Mackenzie nodded toward the few suitcases his team had brought with them.
Let's get the room squared away, then go see about dinner.
Sure.
I'm going to assign a couple men to watch over our things in the rooms. Would you like them to keep your bag?
No, thanks anyway.
Okay.
Mackenzie leaned down and picked up one of the bags. He led the way. After freshening up in her room, Anya met Mackenzie in the lobby, and they had dinner at a small restaurant only a few blocks from their hotel. For a time, they ate in silence. Anya watched Mackenzie out of the corner of her eye and caught him watching her as well.
Something on your mind?
No.
Yes? Good. In just a bit.
He then put his phone away and glanced at Anya.
One of my team has found a man who has information about Mustafa. I'm going to talk to him in a few minutes.
No, we're going to speak to him.
Not a good idea.
Perhaps not, but that's how it'll be.
That's how you want it.
Anya walked a step behind Mackenzie as they entered one of the many alleyways that threaded through the city. One of Mackenzie's men walked 30 feet ahead of them. Two others trailed them. Two more sat in rental cars on either end of the alley, prepared to speed to the rescue if necessary. Mackenzie had his hand on a pistol tucked into his belt at his back waistband.
You do realize this could be a trap.
Yeah, that's pretty much the reason I wanted you to stay behind.
The point man walked past the target doorway and stood against the alley wall, hidden in the shadows and holding a machine pistol beneath his light jacket. Mackenzie stopped in front of the door.
You ready to do this?
Yes.
Anya hitched her backpack a little to one side with her left hand and closed her right around the hilt of the sword in the other wear. One good yank and it would be in the alley with them. Mackenzie kept his right hand on his pistol, turned sideways to make himself a skinnier target, and rapped on the door. A moment later, a peephole slid open in the center of the door. Weak moonlight danced in the whites of the man's eyes as he peered out.
You are Walker?
Yes.
How many men did you bring with you?
Three.
Only you and one of the men can enter, and a woman.
The woman stays out here.
That is a mistake.
What is?
Leaving the woman out here. It is not safe for a woman so beautiful.
Look,
If you wish to have the information you requested about Mustafa, the woman must enter. This is, a deal breaker.
I'm coming in.
Good. We have very fine cheese and bread.
An impressive number of men could be seen inside. Mackenzie shot Anya a look.
Do you know what you're getting yourself into?
With me, that gives us three people on the other side of that door. Shouldn't you be feeling a little better about that?
You like taking risks, don't you, archaeologist?
Before Anya could answer, the door was open. The arched entrance was dark, but light gleamed off to the left. In the center of the courtyard lay a garden. At least two shadows patrolled on the upper floor walkway across from the entrance. The gatekeeper stood revealed in the dim light. He wore a white shirt and pants and a tan keffiyeh. His short beard split to reveal his bright smile as he half-bowed and waved Anya inside.
Please to enter.
Anya did, with Mackenzie and Yahya following her along the narrow stone path that led to an enclosed dining patio. The table glowed with candlelight. A lean, wolfish man with a neatly cropped black beard stood up from behind the table as Anya approached. He wore an elegant suit, and in the candlelight, he loomed large against the stone wall behind him.
Ah, welcome to my humble home. I am Hussein. I know who you are, Miss Creed. I have enjoyed your show on several occasions.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
And you are?
You can call me Al.
Please sit.
Hussein gestured to the chairs around the table. Anya slid out of her backpack, but set it close to her chair. As the gatekeeper had promised, there was bread and cheese, along with several selections of fruit.
Help yourselves.
We just ate, and we don't have much time.
All right. What do you wish to know?
Mustafa's location, how many men he has. I was told you were the one who would know.
And I do.
My friends were kidnapped by him 3 days ago.
The archaeological expedition, yes, I had heard. Most unfortunate, but you're here to rectify that, are you not?
Tell us what you know about Mustafa.
Do you have a map?
The mercenary reached into his shirt pocket with his left hand. His right hand had never left his hip. Yahya remained apart from the table and had taken up a position across the enclosed space from the man who had answered the door. The young man's attention was directed solely at Hussein's apparent majordomo, who had also stayed away from the table. Other than the open front of the dining enclosure, a door behind Hussein led into what Anya guessed was the main house. One-handed, Mackenzie brought out the map, shook it once so that it unfolded, and laid it on the table. Hussein smiled and gestured to the map.
May I?
Be my guest.
Mackenzie slid the map across. Studying the map, Hussein took out a pen and his cell phone. He thumbed the screen a few times, then studied it, as the soft blue glow played over his hard features. The light revealed that he was older than Anya had believed, probably in his mid to late 40s.
I have the coordinates for Mustafa's last known location.
Hussein wrote quickly, his handwriting clean and uniform.
How did you get those coordinates?
I had business with him.
What kind of business?
The kind of business that I do. I sold him guns.
Hussein looked up and gently pushed the map back across the table. Again using one hand, Mackenzie refolded the map and put it back in his shirt pocket.
How many guns?
Several.
What kind?
Military grade.
What about the number of men?
30, possibly 35. If the group gets much larger, Mustafa is going to find it hard to remain hidden out there. He doesn't have a lot of supporters. He has lived a violent life, and I expect him to meet a violent end. As for yourself, Al, you have a choice.
A choice?
About whether you meet a violent end.
The ruby-red disc of a sniper scope dawned on Mackenzie's chest. Anya spotted the light immediately, and couldn't help checking her own chest to see if another had formed there. Nothing. Smiling and self-assured, Hussein produced a pistol from under the table.
Mustafa didn't buy just my guns. He also bought my services. He wants Anya Creed alive, but he doesn't care whether you live or die. So which will it?
Mackenzie lifted his boot to the table's edge and drove it into Hussein's chest. Pushed back by the force he'd used on the table, Mackenzie somersaulted backwards before the gunner with the scope could fire. The gatekeeper brought out a pistol, but he had no chance to set his sights. Yahya's draw was faster. He dropped into a loose roll and came to his feet beside the houseman. Yahya popped one in the man's head to ensure the kill, then rose up in a half crouch against the stone wall. Bailing from her chair, Anya looked back along the stone pathway, closed her hand on the sword's hilt, and yanked it from the other wear. She leaped onto the table, crossed it in one stride, and jumped down again to confront Hussein. The man lay stunned on his back. Anya kicked the pistol from his hand and fisted his shirt. He tried to reach for her, but Anya ducked forward and yanked him up. Anya headbutted the man's face. He fell back, looking dazed. Blood streamed from his nose and mouth. Behind Anya, Mackenzie rolled to his feet with his pistol in both hands. He and Yahya laid down cover fire that brought them a brief respite from the men closing in from the courtyard. Still in a crouch, Anya reached out and pitched the heavy table over. Judging from the weight and the solid wood construction, it would provide a brief barrier from flying bullets.
Mackenzie, back here!
Yahya!
Together, the two men crouched behind the shelter with Anya and Hussein. Anya felt certain from the muzzle flashes she saw that 8 or 10 gunmen were closing on their position. Getting back the way they'd come was out of the question. She glared down at Hussein.
On your feet!
Hussein tried, but couldn't quite manage it. Anya pulled him up. Shards of stone spat into his face.
Stop shooting! Stop shooting!
Hussein wrapped his arms around his head and ducked. Anya shoved Hussein toward the door.
Open it.
Hussein fumbled with the door, finally getting it to open back into the adjacent building. Dim electric light filled the 8-foot hallway that led into the house's main room. Hussein started forward. Anya held on to him by his shirt collar as she grabbed her backpack from where she had left it, then followed.
How many men are in the house?
I don't know.
Anya yanked on Hussein's shirt collar at the same time she kicked the man's foot sideways, causing him to trip. Then she rammed Hussein's face into the wall. She let him feel the razor-sharp sword's edge against his neck.
Don't lie to me or I'll kill you right here.
5 or 6? I don't know. I don't keep track of all of them.
Sloppy management. Guess you missed the Villainy for Dummies book.
Hussein wiped his face as Anya propelled him forward. She glanced over her shoulder and saw that Mackenzie and Yahya were following. Both men held their pistols up before them and remained in crouches as they backed toward her. As they stepped into the main room, Anya spotted the sniper up on the second floor landing, crouching behind his rifle at the railing. Only 40 feet away, the sniper didn't have to be a crack shot to hit his target.
Mackenzie!
Anya kept Hussein in front of her despite his attempt to get away, but two more men in the room were closing in on her fast. Desperately, Anya shoved her captive forward, trying to keep him upright, but Hussein went down, tripping over his own feet. Anya released her hold on the man and released the sword. She sprinted across the room as a bullet clipped her cheek. The two men who had closed on her were suddenly behind her, lifting their weapons. Anya ran for all she was worth, veering to her left. She reached up the wall. Flying upwards with all her momentum, Anya gained two steps up the wall. She just managed to catch the railing of the second floor landing in one hand. Anya swung forward, caught hold with her other hand, and vaulted over the railing. The sniper tried to whirl around. Anya spun and delivered a roundhouse kick to the man's head that knocked him over the railing. The rifle, abandoned as he fell, teetered on the railing for an instant before Anya seized it. She pointed at the nearest man downstairs. The sniper crash-landed, then pulled the trigger. The bullet caught her target in the chest. Surprised, the man staggered for a moment, tried to shoot his weapon, then sprawled over Hussein. The other man already had Anya in his sights. But Mackenzie shot him through the head before the man got off his shot. Mackenzie put a foot on Hussein as the man tried to get up. Mackenzie shot him in the face, then brought out his sat phone.
Mayday.
Anya tossed the rifle aside and raced down the steps. Yahya exchanged bullets with the men in the hallway, keeping them pinned down, while Mackenzie opened the front door. A moment later, Mackenzie led the way outside, immediately turning right to face the oncoming car driving without its headlights on. Mackenzie ushered Anya and Yahya into the car. When he closed the door, Mackenzie took the front passenger seat for himself. Then he reloaded his weapon and slid it out of sight just as they roared out onto the street. Back at the hotel, Anya felt hollowed out and was regretting eating so heavily at dinner. She expected more of Hussein's gunmen, or the local police, to jump her at any moment. Mackenzie walked her to her door.
You gonna be all right?
I'm fine, thanks.
That move up the wall, that was pretty awesome.
Adrenaline.
Are you okay in there by yourself?
I'm fine, but what about the police, or Hussein's men?
Hussein's people are gonna be looking for a new employer. A lot of them will scatter back to the streets. As for the police, seeing as they're not here now, I'm betting they don't know anything about us. Strangers wander in and out of this city every day. We get through tonight, we'll be gone by first light. Nothing left of us but a vapor trail. Get a good night's sleep. You'll need it tomorrow.
You too.
Mackenzie turned and walked away. Anya watched him go, noting the bloodstains on his pant leg from when he'd shot Hussein on the ground. She made herself turn away and open the hotel room door. While Anya had been out, responses to her queries came in on the user sites. Anya was grateful for that. As tired as she was still buzzing with adrenaline and knew she wasn't going to be able to sleep for a while. She sat cross-legged on the floor and cradled her notebook computer in her lap. Freshly showered, she felt somewhat better, but she wanted to be back in her loft in Brooklyn, surrounded by all her things. With all her electronics plugged in and charging, she went through the research sites and forums she usually haunted, but came up with nothing but speculation about Abdelilah Karam's work. The strangest theory was posted by Demon Scientist at blackartsbedone.org.
Everybody knows how Solomon locked all the demons in his seals, but not everybody knows that Abdelilah Karam was doing the same thing for the Muslims. Do you really think that Christianity named all the demons? No. Muhammad believed he'd been possessed by demons. Check it. Abdelilah Karam was locking away all the Muslim demons unleashed by the writing of the Quran.
Anya sorted through the rest of the emails and most of the forums and didn't find anything new. However, when she checked her personal email and phone log, she discovered messages left by Dr. Khadija Zaid, a historian from Aligarh Muslim University's Center of Advanced Study.
Miss Creed, what an amazing discovery. I congratulate you on your good fortune. I only just learned of your interest in Abdalila Karam through a mutual acquaintance, Dr. Wolcott. Ernest is a dear friend. Also, I know he has a colleague working with you on translating the manuscript you found. I can't wait to hear what he has to say once he has finished. This must be very exciting for you. I believe I have some information you need. Abdalila Karam was encouraged by Muhammad himself to keep the Muslim people together. You see, Muhammad knew, in the days of his failing health, that his succession would be most troubling. Given that the Muslim community, my community in fact, has indeed become fractured, Muhammad was, of course, most prophetic. But I would like to talk to you about Karam at some point. Perhaps I could offer you new insight into what he may have been doing in Morocco. Yours most warmly, Khadija Zaid.
Well, well, Professor Zaid, I would like to speak with you too.
Anya opened her sat phone's address book and entered the professor's information. It was too late to call now, but Anya resolved to do so first thing in the morning. Waiting till then was going to be hard. Yahya sat across from Mackenzie at the breakfast table in the small restaurant near the hotel. Mackenzie glanced through the window and watched Anya Creed as she leaned against the building and talked on her sat phone in the morning shade. She ate out there as well, dipping her hand occasionally into her takeout bag.
Do you know who the woman is talking to?
No.
She seems very excited.
She does.
She doesn't even know if her companions are still alive.
She hopes they are. You can see it in her eyes. It's not about those people the Bedouin have. She's an archaeologist. It has to do with that scroll they found when the Bedouin took them prisoner. She hopes to recover the rest of it.
Do you think it's a treasure map?
No.
Why?
She's never referred to it as a map. Neither have the people who sent us here.
Do you think they would know?
I do.
Or that they would tell us?
Well, that would be another matter.
It must lead to a treasure.
Why?
Nothing else would be so important. This man, Habib.
Yahya, listen to me. Never mention that name. It's a very dangerous name to use carelessly in public.
Of course, I'm sorry.
I'm telling you this only for your own protection.
I understand.
I understand that you don't trust a woman. You shouldn't, and I don't. But you should trust that you know what she is after, what she can do. She wants whatever secrets are in that scroll, and her mission isn't done until she gets her hands on what she is missing.
As you say.
They sat quietly at the table and watched Anya Creed through the dirty window. If she knew they were watching, she ignored them. A man entered the restaurant and stood in the doorway for a moment to acclimate his vision. He was dark enough to pass for a Moroccan, but his suit was expensive and European. He slipped off his sunglasses and glanced around the room until he saw Mackenzie. Leaning back slightly, Mackenzie dropped his left hand to the pistol holstered at his hip under his shirt. A moment later, the man approached the table and stopped just out of reach. He smiled politely.
Mr. Mackenzie.
I don't know you.
I was sent here to speak with you.
Who sent you?
Someone who would pay most handsomely for your time.
I'm not interested.
You're making a mistake?
Go away.
The person I work for could also have your life snuffed out in an instant for your insult.
Not by you. You'll be dead as soon as you give the order. If your boss has told you anything about me, he's told you I don't mind killing.
Shifting only a little, Mackenzie freed the pistol he carried and pointed it at the man. He hid all but the muzzle beneath his arm. Yahya also had his weapon trained on the newcomer and was searching around the room for anyone who might be in collusion.
I was told to offer you twice what you're being paid.
Why not make it three times that amount?
I was told that can be arranged.
Do you even know how much I'm being paid?
No.
Then go away.
I was told to get a definitive answer from you.
Would a bullet through the lung be definitive enough?
Grimacing, the man turned and walked back the way he'd come.
He is not happy.
Neither am I.
He seemed very serious.
I believe he was.
Do you know who he works for?
Yes.
The one whose name you do not wish me to speak.
I believe so.
This is a very dangerous man, and you've just offended him.
But he offended me first, thinking I could be bought off. Besides, Yahya, a man who offers to buy you off after he's tried to kill you is neither sincere nor trustworthy.
I suppose you're right.
Yahya studied the room. Then he looked back at Anya Creed on the other side of the window.
However, the lengths the man is willing to go in order to get whatever Anya Creed is after makes me think it must be worth quite a lot.
Yes.
I am curious as to how much it is worth, and if it is worth enough for us to consider retiring from this business after taking it.
Something to consider.
Raleigh Hendricks shivered. Then he realized it was the phone vibrating against his chest. He came fully awake and sat up in the darkness of his bedroom. Caller ID showed blocked, 2:18 a.m. Only one blocked caller could be reaching him on this line. He punched the answer button and held the handset to his ear.
Hendricks.
Contact was made.
Good.
Evidently your target is getting antsy.
Oh, because of your people?
No, because of whatever the woman is doing.
Do you know what that is?
No.
What happened?
One of your target's men tried to bribe my agent.
And?
My agent turned down the offer. We're pushing the ball back in your target's corner. Let him make the first mistake.
All right. Keep me apprised.
Of course. Get some sleep, Raleigh. You sound horrible.
As she leaned against the wall behind her and kept watch of the foot and vehicle traffic around her, Anya knew Mackenzie observed her from the small restaurant at the corner. She made certain she didn't step out of his view because she didn't want to worry him while she talked with Professor Khadija Zaid.
How much do you know about Philip Gardiner and his service aboard the Spanish ships?
Not much.
Anya referred to her journal and flipped through the notes she'd taken while talking to Ernest Wolcott.
I've been on the run and I haven't actually been in the best place to research what I've found.
That may not be true. Philip Gardiner's work caught the eye of a rather skilled Syrian historian, Dr. Ulker Bozdag. Have you heard of him?
No. Can you spell it?
Of course. U-L-K-E-R-B-O-Z-D-A-G. I'm not surprised that you haven't heard of him, Miss Creed.
Call me Anya, please.
If you were not interested in the caliphs immediately following Muhammad, you would never run across his name. Even at that, he would be hard to find. Bozdag was trained at Oxford in the 1960s and fell in love with pop culture, and he adored the notion of hidden puzzles lying about in history.
There appear to be no shortage of those kinds of puzzles. I've tripped across a few myself.
You're familiar with the Battle of Basra, yes?
Yes, also known as the Battle of the Camel. Muhammad's widow, Aisha, rallied forces around her to chase down Uthman's assassins.
So it is written in some histories. In other histories, Aisha was making her bid to control the caliphate by naming Muhammad's true heir after Uthman's death.
As I recall, that didn't work out for her. Ali ibn Abd Munaf became the fourth caliph despite her protests. Ali let her live, but he banished her.
To Medina, yes. And she lived there for the rest of her life, probably as a very bitter woman.
As one of Muhammad's wives.
Purportedly his favorite.
She had everything. Then she was left with nothing.
She was still referred to as the mother of the believers. But while Muhammad was alive, Aisha led a fuller life than most women could expect. She was an expert politician and theologian. When she spoke, men listened. Then, with Muhammad's death, all of that was lost. Except for one thing. Aisha still had the services of Abdalillah Karam, the historian. She died in 678. Did you pinpoint the time that Karam was in Morocco?
698 at the earliest. There were gold coins with his body that were struck in 79 AH.
20 years after Aisha's death?
Yes.
Interesting.
But what does any of this have to do with Bozdag?
You are familiar with the Yazidi?
Sure. Kurdish people living in the Mosul region in Iraq.
There are also groups of them living in Transcaucasia, Turkey, Armenia, and Syria.
Bozdag is from Syria.
So you see how this begins to come together.
I do.
Have you heard of the Melektaus?
No.
I'd have been surprised if you had. The Melektaus is also called the Order of the Peacock Angel. They also have another name, Shaitan, which is the same name the Quran has for Satan.
Living in Muslim countries, I'll bet the order wasn't popular.
No, and it still isn't. They have a story about a jinn, a genie named Iblis, who refused to acknowledge Adam as superior over him. In the Muslim belief, Iblis became the leader of the fallen angels, the devil in Christian terms. Bozdag became fascinated by the Melektaus while in London. He was a young man at the time and was convinced that he'd found his calling. His university was not so enchanted with this, and he was released from his contract. However, he traveled back and forth to Fez, Morocco, to continue his studies.
The University of Al-Karawin.
Exactly. The university there is one of the most influential areas of study in the Muslim world. So if anyone would have information on the Melek Taos, Bozdag felt certain that university would. He secured a teaching position at the university and worked there until he died in 1983. Some of the papers he left behind mention his follow-up work on Philip Gardiner's investigation into Abdulillah Karam.
Bozdag couldn't have found the scroll that was with Karam. It was still buried.
No, but he did find another. This one was written by a young historian from Persia who claimed to have been learning his craft from Abdulillah Karam. That scroll, written by Alal Khaldun, was included in the papers kept at the university. Bozdag wrote a small monograph that underscored the thought that Philip Gardiner had been with the Barbary pirates and had gotten his Kufic scrolls from Morocco. Of course, at the time, no one really cared. But if you can find papers written by Abdulillah Karam detailing events during the Caliphate Wars, this could be a spectacular discovery. The Battle of Basra divided the Muslim people, splitting them into factions of Sunni and Shiite.
Khadija, I really appreciate your time this morning.
Do not just appreciate my time. You have made me most curious. When you have the story, please share it with me. And if you ever find yourself in India, let me know. I would love to meet you.
I will. Thanks again.
Anya disconnected. She turned and walked back to the restaurant, hoping she could get her hands on the missing piece of the scroll, and that Smythe and the others were still in one piece. Less than an hour later, Anya was leaving Marrakesh by camel. Mackenzie had purchased the animals from a local merchant. Outfitting his team had cost quite a lot, and Anya had to wonder again at how Mackenzie was so free with his money. She wasn't convinced that Mustafa was sitting on a treasure trove out in the mountains. The sun burned down, and Anya was certain the temperature had gotten up to nearly 90. By noon, it would be close to unbearable. She wore khaki shorts she'd purchased in the market and a white tunic top. Sunscreen covered her exposed skin and face. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and she wore a baseball cap and aviator-style sunglasses. Her gear was rolled behind the saddle, additional clothing, water, and food, but she wore her backpack. If things somehow went sideways, she didn't want to be separated from her things. Mackenzie had given her a Glock 17 and made her show proficiency with handling the weapon before he was satisfied. Anya kept it hidden when they'd ridden through Marrakesh, but now that they were out in the wilderness, she wore it on her hip. Mackenzie rode his camel next to hers. He didn't quite look comfortable riding the beast, and Anya had to struggle to keep from smiling at him as he fought against rocking back and forth. Anya had little difficulty settling back into her camel's awkward gait.
How far out from the Bedouin camp do you think we are?
13.2 miles.
Anya had just checked the GPS on her notebook computer.
How fast do these beasts travel?
Anywhere from 20 to 35 miles a day.
So we can look forward to 6 to 7 hours in the saddle before we find your friends.
Uh-huh.
I hate camels.
That beats walking.
Yeah, I just wish we could bring vehicles out here.
You could. Of course, they break down and leave you stranded with a long walk home. And they'd definitely stir up more dust and make more noise than these camels will. Camels have ninja mode.
That doesn't make them smell any better.
Two hours later, Mackenzie called a stop to rest and water the camels. The animals didn't need much water to survive, but he was sensible about taking care of them. Anya sat cross-legged in the slender swath of shade created by the camel she'd been riding. She'd watered the animal, and it had hunkered down immediately. A gentle wind stirred up small dust devils that whirled like dervishes across the dry land. After consulting her notebook computer to get the GPS coordinates, Anya shut the device down and put it away. Charging the battery wasn't going to be a problem because she'd also picked up a solar charger as well as a hand crank charger in the marketplace. Mackenzie walked over. He looked at her from under the wide brim of the hat he'd purchased. He wore his wraparound sunglasses.
Did you water your camel?
First thing.
How far are we from Mustafa now?
7.6 miles.
We're making better time than I thought.
And we've been across terrain we would have had to avoid in jeeps equipped with four-wheel drive.
We should catch up to Mustafa in another 3-4 hours.
Probably.
I'm going to have to think about that. We come up on them in the daytime and they see us, they might open fire without checking who we are. Plus, we'd have to keep you out of sight. Even if they don't drop us, Mustafa could start killing hostages. We wouldn't have any leverage at all. All we've got out here is surprise. And the only way to maintain that is to creep up on them in the middle of the night.
So we need to stop somewhere between here and there.
Yeah.
Mackenzie reached into his shirt pocket and took out a map of the region.
I need to find a place that's not far from the Bedouin camp.
Well, there's an old fort about 6 miles up. It's practically on the way, maybe a quarter mile north of our heading.
You've already been looking?
Yep.
Not bad for a television star.
Archaeologist first, then television star. And as an archaeologist, I've learned a few things.
Like finding out places to cold camp.
Like that.
We can live with a quarter mile out of the way.
Mackenzie started studying his map.
Oh, the fort isn't on that map. I found it on satellite imagery I downloaded of the area. I stored the files on my computer.
Did you now? Girl Scout when you were a kid?
Better. I was raised by nuns.
All right. You lead the way to this fort you found.
Anya rode at the front of the caravan after they remounted, with Mackenzie to her right and Yahya on her left. Both of them carried assault rifles, the buttstocks resting on their thighs. The others on the mercenary team behind them carried their weapons the same way. Anya couldn't help thinking that they looked like a military expedition. If they'd crossed paths with any of the small trade caravans that still carried goods back and forth across the mountains, they would have scared them away. The weapons reminded Anya of how much danger Smythe and the others were in. 3 hours later, she spotted the ruins of the old fort ahead of them. Three of the stone walls still stood, but the fourth lay loosely scattered inside and outside the original perimeter. When it had stood, the fort had held 3 rooms. They settled the camels on the north side of the building against one of the walls and watered them again. Although they weren't thirsty, the camels drank. The animals knew to take advantage of resources. This time, Mackenzie saw that the animals were fed. With the camel behind her, quietly chewing its food, Anya studied the GPS readings on her notebook computer. They were only a mile and a quarter from the Bedouin campsite. Satisfied, she powered the computer down and replaced it in her backpack. Mackenzie walked over to her and nodded at the ground.
Mind if I sit?
Go ahead.
Slipping the assault rifle off of his shoulder, Mackenzie sat cross-legged.
How far are we from Mustafa?
A little over a mile.
The moon's gonna be bright tonight.
3/4. A new moon would have been better, but we didn't get to pick the timing.
You pay attention to a lot.
It's part of my job.
Right. Archaeologist. What can you tell me about this place?
What do you want to know?
Yeah, it was built in the middle of nowhere. Why would they do that?
Morocco was a trade center. Merchants formed caravans during the months when they had crops and goods to sell. Salt and gold flowed from North Africa to South Africa, then made its way into the Western world.
In slaves?
Yes, later. In the beginning, it was salt and gold, and crops specific to this part of the world. Those caravans crossed incredible distances as the merchants took great risks to become wealthy. A ship crossing the ocean wasn't as vulnerable as those caravans because they carried warriors and fortifications with them.
So, somebody came up with the idea of sticking warriors out here to protect those caravans.
Yeah.
How did these guys make their money?
Donations from kings and merchants who wanted safe passage for their goods. Some of them probably bought things and did some speculating on their own as they traveled back and forth. The same way you're speculating on Mustafa's gun collection. Some of them probably hired out to journey with the caravans to the seaports, then brought back things to sell locally to the other men stationed here. Maybe those warriors went north or south to small villages where they could sell those items for inflated prices.
A savvy fellow could set himself up with a nice side business.
Exactly. A market gets created. People have to ship goods there, and an enforcement arm comes into being out of necessity. The gravitation from enforcer to merchant for someone that's clever was a natural thing.
It still is. I know a lot of guys who figured they were smarter than their bosses and decided to take over. But just because a man can pull a trigger doesn't mean he has the smarts to run a business.
I'll take your word for it.
Well, I don't think you have to take my word for it. I'm sure you could tick off such stories from history without even working up a sweat.
Just sitting in this heat has me working up a sweat.
Well, let's say your friends are still alive and we can get them all away in one piece.
I don't want to think it'll go any other way.
Then don't. My team and I, we're good at this. But what comes next for you? Are you going to keep chasing whatever it is you're looking for on that scroll?
I am.
Do you know what it's about yet?
Do you mean, is it a treasure map?
I guess so.
No, not as far as I know.
But it could be.
Are you a betting man?
Nature of the business, girl. Nothing I do is without risk, and when I risk, I'm all in.
I wouldn't bet on this being a treasure map.
Then what are you betting on?
I'm not betting. I'm curious. So we find this old guy. He's got to have been in his 80s when he made the trip to Morocco, which was only then coming under Islamic control under Uqba ibn Nafi for the Umayyad Caliphate. I can't help wondering what he was doing out here. Why would he leave his home and come all this way to die on a trip to where? More than that, why did someone kill him?
He was murdered?
I guess I didn't tell you that.
No.
Somebody crushed his skull.
To get what he had?
Maybe.
You know what he was carrying with him?
I don't. This man was a historian, not a politician or person of wealth. He was just an old man.
He wasn't just an old man to everybody. Whoever killed him, they thought he was a threat.
Grabbing his rifle, Mackenzie used it to help push himself to his feet.
Yeah, when you get the story, let me know how it goes. I'm interested.
But not enough to go chasing after it with me?
I'm a risk taker, but only when I know there's a potential payday involved. We've got a few hours before night. Try to get some rest. Once it gets dark, we're going to be busy.
Garin pulled the Melkus RS-2000 up to the curb in front of the Goth nightclub in the Mitte district of Berlin. Dozens of people wearing leather and rubber and all things vampire stood in line against the side of the three-story warehouse that housed Club Ravenswing. A valet dressed in black trotted over to the sports car as the driver's side door gulled up and Garin stepped out. The valet held out his hand.
Keys, sir?
No, the car is staying here.
Garin clicked the key fob and the door gulled back down.
Sir, you can't park here.
Garin stood straight, towering over the younger man. At 6'4" tall and built broad, Garin was an imposing figure. He wore black pants, a black turtleneck, and a black duster that dropped to mid-calf, nicely concealing his weapons. Garin ripped the valet's identification card off his lapel.
The car is staying here. Furthermore, if it is not here when I get back, Joachim, then I'm going to hold you personally responsible. Do you understand?
Perfectly. I understand perfectly.
Good.
Garin took a 500 euro note out of his coat pocket and shoved it into the valet's hand. Garin brushed by him and strode toward the club's entrance. Two large men kept watch over the doors, which had been remodeled to look like folded bat wings. The men were dressed in black clothing with security written on their chests in German and English. One of them stepped forward. A baton shot out of his right hand, but he kept it close to his leg.
You cannot go in.
Garin hit the man in the throat with two fingers, pulling the blow just enough to keep from crushing the trachea and killing him. The man dropped to his knees. Garin caught the abandoned baton before it hit the ground. The man's partner set up in a defensive position. Garin brought the baton up between the man's legs. Then Garin shoved him aside as he collapsed and threw up. Still in motion, he opened the door and dropped the baton at his feet. The inside of the club was designed to look like hell. Digitized flames cascaded around the walls as laser lighting flickered out over the gyrating crowd. Spinning spheres that resembled flaming asteroids swung from the ceiling and projected the lasers. Garin was surprised that the repeat clientele hadn't gone deaf from the loud music. Cocktail waitresses wearing shimmering red camisoles, tiny thong shorts, high heels, and horns circulated through the crowd. Bars occupied both sides of the club. At the other end of the expansive dance floor, a DJ dressed as a young Dracula ran the sound. A young waitress stood to Garin's left.
Can I get you something to drink?
No, thank you.
Garin laid a 100 euro note on her serving tray. He strode past her, knowing without asking that Eniko would be in the back of the club holding court. The dancers on the floor parted ahead of him as he crossed. A few of the men frowned, but the women gazed at him with interest. He ignored them all, watching for shifting that went against the grain of the whirling bodies. Eniko was expecting him. She had to be. Three men converged on Garin before he reached the other end of the club. Cameras mounted on the flaming asteroids captured video of the crowd and mixed it with the fiery footage on the walls. He saw himself, and he also saw the aggressors coming for him. They cut through the dancers like sharks through an ocean. Evidently, the security crew at the front had radioed ahead. Tracking their movement, Garin saw that they came from the left. That was where Eniko would be, back in the area cut off from the dance floor by one-way glass. The first man to reach Garin was nearly 7 feet tall, a steroid-induced giant that would have intimidated a lesser man. The giant threw a straight punch, whipping his other hand back to his hip in a martial arts swivel. Garin slipped the blow and threw his right arm up at the same time he lifted his right leg. Pivoting and shifting his weight, Garin drove his right foot against the side of the man's right leg, snapping the knee. He also trapped the man's right arm before his opponent could recover it. Then Garin slammed his left forearm into the man's elbow, shattering that joint as well. The man tried to stay erect. Garin spun him long enough to use him as a human shield against the second attacker, a man only slightly smaller than the first. Garin shoved him forward. Although the second man tried to escape the first, the giant caught his comrade in a one-armed bear hug that effectively put him in a straitjacket. Mercilessly, Garin stepped in behind the second man before he could turn. And he clapped both hands over the man's ears. The twin blows ruptured the man's eardrums. Fighting vertigo, the man stumbled and went down with the first man clinging desperately to him. Garin had momentarily lost track of the third man. But as he started to turn, the third guard's fist exploded against his jaw. Taking a step back as the dancers fled the floor, Garin grinned at his opponent.
Try that again, when I'm looking this time.
The man launched another flurry of blows, all of them capable and all of them coming within millimeters of striking home. Garin had to move quickly to escape. He kept his elbows in so as not to telegraph his blows. Garin used a combination of Krav Maga punches, snapping jabs and elbows into the man's face. The man staggered back. Unconscious, the man fell backward and sprawled to the floor. Garin stepped over him and headed toward the small room at the back of the club. Security personnel boiled out from behind the bar. Garin reached under his jacket and took out the nickel-plated Desert Eagle 50 caliber. He pointed the big muzzle at the approaching men. They froze where they were. A woman emerged from the darkness of the back room. She was tall, statuesque, with a face that had been emblazoned on the covers of fashion magazines and tabloids around the world. Sultry and contemptuous, her brilliant red hair, a stunning alchemy from a hairdresser's palette and barely reaching her shoulders, Eniko was in her early 30s, but looked 10 years younger with her pale skin. Eniko waved the security away as she regarded Garin. She wore a shimmering emerald dress that barely covered her breasts and threatened to become immodest around her hips at any moment. Matching calf-high boots sheathed her long legs. She smiled.
Garin.
I came for the amulet you stole from me.
Stole? Such a harsh word between friends.
I said harsher ones a few hours ago when I discovered you'd switched out the amulet. Then there were a few others while I tracked you down, and more on the way over here.
Are you certain the amulet is a fake?
Garin stared at her. Crossing her arms over her impressive cleavage, Eniko shrugged.
Well, I suppose you would be.
Garin lifted his hand to her face and thought how easy it would be to smash her beauty. In lieu of hitting her, Garin leaned forward and kissed Eniko gently on the cheek. He pulled back and looked into her eyes.
You're lucky I have decided to let you live.
You could never kill me.
Don't bet on it.
Is there no one you love, Garin Brayden?
No.
A man shouldn't live without love.
Where is my amulet?
In here.
Eniko turned, and he let her go, then followed her. The room was small, filled with couches and comfortable chairs. The wall with the one-way glass looked out over the dance floor. Another wall held several monitors, many of them trained on the club's interior, and some of them showing various television channels. Eniko walked to a couch and reached into her purse. Garin readied himself to lift the Desert Eagle if it came to that. Keeping her movements in view, Eniko pulled a small jewelry box out of her purse. With a tight smile, she opened the box to show him the contents. The amulet, a design dug deeply into the gold, revealed an ankh with blue sapphires at the four points. Egyptian hieroglyphics were on the obverse. Eniko offered the box to Garin. He plucked the amulet from the soft bed and felt the weight of it, heavier than it looked because of the gold. This was real. He couldn't explain how he knew that, but he did.
What is the amulet?
Mine.
Garin pocketed it, but didn't put the pistol away.
Why is it so important? You had me go to the trouble of getting it for you.
Nothing you'd be interested in.
Then tell me why you're so interested in it.
No.
Garin gazed around the room.
Looking for the back way out?
No, I'm walking out the way I came in. And if any of your little friends show up, I'm going to put a bullet in their heads and let you explain it to the police.
They'll arrest you.
No, they won't. And you know that.
Garin took Eniko by the arm and led her back toward the dance floor. Garin glanced at caller ID and saw that it was Anya. As he answered the call, Garin swept his gaze over the club crowd. Most of the people stood back, warily watching him. He kept moving.
Yes.
Are you busy?
Not terribly. What do you need?
Have you heard of the Melek Taus?
The Angels of Destruction?
Those are the ones.
Garin gazed around the club at all the men and women in their make-believe demon costumes and vampire dress.
Something funny?
It's a location joke. What do you want to know about the Melek Taus?
Everything. There's a new angle on this dig that might require further exploration.
Can't you do that yourself?
Normally I could, but we're about to stage a rescue and my time is limited, especially since we could be running for our lives shortly. I thought maybe you could take a minute and have some of your research people send me a background portfolio.
I don't live to serve at your beck and call.
Chalk it up as a favor. I'll owe you one.
Garin thought of the curious amulet and the secrets it protected. Having Anya owe him one might not be such a bad thing. He was almost to the front door.
All right. Call me when you're ready.
I will. I have to go.
Keep safe.
Garin pocketed the phone. He headed through the door, his hand once more around Eniko's upper arm. The bouncers gave Garin a wide berth. Garin used the key fob to open the Melkus's door before he reached the vehicle.
Nice car.
At the door, Garin turned to her and leaned down to kiss her. She turned her face up to meet him. They had been lovers recently, and he sensed that she was expecting to be again. Garin kissed her on the forehead, and she looked at him in shock.
What was that?
Goodbye.
Garin slid into the car and closed the gullwing door.
Goodbye?
Garin thumbed down the window.
You betrayed me.
I was going to give you the amulet after I figured out what it was and what it meant to you.
What it meant to me was that I can't trust you.
This was a test?
No, an unfortunate circumstance. I liked you well enough, but sometimes things don't work out.
Garin, wait! You can trust me! I swear!
No, never again.
Shaking his head, Garin started the car's powerful engine. Pressing the accelerator, he let out the clutch and roared into the street. He used the car's Bluetooth to put in a call to Sepp Walker, one of his primary researchers. The young man had a way with computers and the internet that was decidedly criminal. Sepp was involved with several of the contracts Garin's international black ops team dealt with.
Mr. Braden, how are you this evening?
I'm fine, Sepp. And you?
Actually, I was about to call you. In the past, you've expressed an interest in Anya Creed.
Yes.
One of our search and seizure assets gave me news about her, a tip he only just received from one of his contacts in the Middle East.
What news?
Apparently, Miss Creed is involved with some clandestine CIA operation in Morocco, springing from repercussions in Algeria. Maybe you knew that?
I know she's in Morocco.
Well, if this man is correct, she's heading for an ambush there.
What do you mean?
She's working with a mercenary. The man she's currently with...
Raphael Mackenzie.
Yes. Mackenzie is being tracked by Habib Ibn Thabit, who is also being sought by the CIA for an ambush that took place in Algeria and resulted in the deaths of several CIA agents. Habib has men following Creed and Mackenzie, and there's a Bedouin named Mustafa waiting for her.
Find out all you can about her, and also an organization called the Melek Taus. This comes first, do you understand?
Of course.
Garin hung up
and immediately dialed the number Anya had called from.